Welcome to The Way Home with Laura Smith, the show that brings you wonderful guests, helpful advice, and uplifting stories. The Way Home, live inspired. Here's your host, Laura Smith.
So good to be with you today. And boy, today is one of those pinch me moments. Why? Because I get to bring you the most beautiful conversation with the incomparable Judy Collins. She is so iconic. Been in the business performing for almost 70 years, and yet her voice is that of a 20-year-old. You've never heard anything so beautiful. She has a new album out, believe it or not, her 55th. You know, you heard me right, 55th album. So we'll be hearing, we have a wonderful interview for you, including some of her iconic music and her new music, and it's all coming up on The Way Home with Laura Smith. We're also going to hear from Linda Jensen, who has a neat book. For those of you, if you have a business, you're thinking of opening a business, or you're wondering what to do with your business, it's called What's Your Exit Strategy? Maximize Your Business Mindset, Minimize the Minefields, Linda Jensen. And of course, good news stories with the wonderful Jim Cleafield. It's all on The Way Home.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Way Home with Laura Smith.
Goes and flows of angel hair and ice cream castles in the air and feathered canyons everywhere. I've looked at clouds that way, but now they only block the sun. They rain and snow on everyone. So many things I would have done.
That is an iconic song called Both Sides Now, which, to even hear it now brings tears to my eyes. It's been something that I've been listening to for almost as long as it was made, but not quite. It's by someone who I know you recognize the voice. She has captivated the world for 7 decades almost with her most incredible, beautiful voice, her songwriting, her presence, her social activism, everything that she has done to make this world a better place. Miss Judy Collins, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Oh, my goodness. I have goosebumps. I'm sorry. I just do. I have goosebumps hearing your voice just speaking and let alone hearing you sing. And it's just I almost have to pinch myself that you're here. We have all, the whole world has been listening to your music for so long, and here you are still writing albums, making new ones, and doing concerts, such as the one you'll be here in Elkhart, Indiana on the 25th of October at the Lerner Theater, which is such a gorgeous theater. You're going to love it.
Oh, thanks so much. I can't wait to get there. You know, I love what I do, and I'm very lucky to be able to do it. And I think it's probably because, you know, I grew up in a traveling situation. My mother, for a long time, drove my father because he was blind. So that was I thought it was a good choice for her to be back behind the wheel. Uh-huh. And he had a radio career of 30 years and starting out in Seattle and then L.A. and then Denver. So we heard my father on the radio every day, practically 5 days a week, usually. And the songs he sang, you know, the Great American Songbook, I'll be seeing you. I wake up to that in all the old familiar places. And then when he was really revved up, he might sing, Oh, Danny Boy, and he'd sing it on the radio too. So I had the Great American Songbook and things that were actually folk music that I was exposed to growing up. So, and also I got to ride in the back of that car. I'm the oldest of five, but for a while, for 4 years, I was the only, the only one.
Oh my goodness. So you were really immersed in with your parents, and what an incredible story to imagine your father being on the radio back. Are we talking the 50s, the 60s?
Well, he started, his radio show started in 1937 in Seattle. And he had graduated from the University of Idaho, summa cum laude, he always used to say, and then clap. He had a few years on the road preceding that as well. So by the time he met my mother in Seattle in 1937, that was the year and the very week that he started his radio career.
No kidding. So we're talking, that's like 80 some years ago, he was doing the radio. And so what was he, singing and talking to the audience? What kind of show was it?
Oh, he was, you know, he did everything. He talked about politics, which is how I got my education in the great folk scare, as they say, sex, drugs, rock and roll. And I always say I didn't do too many drugs. You know, I was afraid that they would interfere with my drinking. So here we are.
That's funny.
With that kind of a model and all of the things that he had to do to live his life, to look good, to be healthy, to carry on. And I, all those things, and also studying the piano, which I did since I was five, they've really helped my own sense of discipline and also the things that I like to do, like get on the stage and sing.
Right. And then so you started with piano, but then obviously we all, you know, see you in our minds as the beautiful woman with the blue eyes and the long hair playing the guitar. But you must have been multi-instrumental.
Well, I didn't play much besides the guitar. I had one swing at the auto harp. I picked up an auto harp when I was in my 30s or 40s to play because I'd written a song called The Fisherman's Song, which was it needed to have another kind of instrument on it. But otherwise, I played the piano, I played the guitar, and that's been the limit. But that's helped me. You know, those instruments have carried me through. You know what it is? It's 65 years since I started doing this. So I started making a living at this.
It's
been a long time.
I bet your parents were very pleased that you sort of followed in the footsteps of your dad in terms of, you know, getting out there in front of an audience and performing. That must have been a great backdrop for you. By the time, though, you were starting to sing, were you based in Colorado?
I started my singing career, getting paid for it. I mean, I did it all the time for free before that. But in 1959, I got my first job at a place called Michael's Pub in Boulder, Colorado. And it was, it had been a quite a wonderful, upstanding Italian restaurant. And in Boulder, Colorado, it was one of three, but it was the best of the bunch. The other two were sort of drunk stops. You know, the Sink and Tulagi's in Boulder were they were highly disreputable. Uh-huh. But Michael's Pub was really something special. And I got an audition there in February of 1959. And the guy, Michael, said to me after I was finished, he said, "Well, I think I'm going to have to hire you." And he sounded unhappy about it. And I said, is that going to be all right? He said, "Well, I want to tell you, I just hate folk music," is what he said. But he hired me.
Because it was probably the music of the day. And in Boulder, if the university was there, you probably had a young crowd that would be very drawn to that, I would imagine.
He had a good thing going. And I played there for many weeks in the beginning until I moved on my second job. I was in Boulder from this February. And then I got my second job in the Central City in Colorado, which is a mining town. And it's also a very hot little town. It had the Teller Opera House is in Central City. And I worked at this little club called the Gilded Garter. And Bob Dylan, when his name was Robert Zimmerman, used to come and sit by me and try to get a job at the club.
Oh, wow.
But I had a great time there. It was wonderful.
Incredible. So then when did you become Judy Collins, as it were? the name that people started to recognize that really took the world by storm with your not only your folk music, but all of these ballads, some of them shared with many of the musicians of the time, both sides now, of course, Joni Mitchell. And but it, back then, you guys would share this music almost, and it would be equally as popular with all of you, or even more with some that didn't write it. So when did you become that type of presence on the stage?
Well, first of all, it always was a day at a time, because in those days, my first manager was Odetta's husband, named Danny Gordon was his name. And it was a matter of, if you go to the club and you sell tickets for 2 or 3 weeks or 4 weeks, you know, then the next club along the way somewhere. And there were a lot of clubs in that day. So I went from the Gilded Garter down to the Exodus in Denver, where I opened for Josh White and for the Terriers and for Bob Gibson, who was the guy who discovered Joan Baez. And it was from there to the next club, to the next club. My fourth big job in Colorado was in Aspen in January of 1960. And I was opening for the Smothers Brothers. And they were only starting, and I was their opener. They were hysterical. I stood in the back between, you know, after my show was done, I stood there and just laughed and laughed. I just adored them. And the feeling was mutual. We had a good time. We laughed a lot. We hung out together. And after that, I was duty bound to take my next job, which was a job in Chicago at the Gate of Horn. Now I was hitting the big time, as you would call it, because the Gate of Horn in Chicago was where a lot of people got their starts, including Odetta. That's where I met Odetta, actually. Mm-hmm. And Will Holt and Dolly Jonah, I opened for. Will Holt wrote Lemon Tree, Very Pretty, and the Lemon Flower is Sweet, but the flowers of the fruit of the poor lemon is impossible to eat. And a lot of people made a lot of money on that song.
Oh, I remember that song. It was huge and beautiful. So you opened for him, and then now you're doing, like you said,
that's right.
The big time. And that was Chicago. Yeah. Right.
And it was Chicago, 60 and then 61. And by that time, by 62, I was in the traveling mode. I got tuberculosis in 62. I had opened in 62 to Theodore Bekele. I opened his Carnegie Hall show in October of 1962. And I mean, that was a huge deal. You know, my manager managed him. He managed the Weavers. He managed Woody Guthrie and Pete Seeger and the Weavers. And, you know, I always like to tell this story because it's kind of funny. The Weavers had a big hit. I didn't realize this because I didn't really get into the whole music scene until I got to New York. And my manager was Harold Leventhal, who managed all these people. But the Weavers had a big hit in 1950. And it was Irene, goodnight, goodnight, Irene. And I won't tell you what the real verse was, because it was kind of anti airwaves.
Oh, okay. Even in 1950. Wow.
But it was a big, big hit. And the Avon company called my manager, Harold, and said, we would like for Pete Seeger and the Weavers to be the voice of Dove Soap. And that was when Pete Seeger quit the Weavers.
Harold became quite wealthy with that.
Harold would not, of course, do that, and neither would Pete. But I'm sure that Harold thought it was very funny, and they all did. So, but by the time I got to New York in 61, my first formal visit, where I was working at Gertie's Folk City, which was a club very similar to the one in Boulder. It was a formerly it was an Italian restaurant with wonderful food, and then the folkies invaded it and turned it into something very popular.
Was this in the village at the time, Greenwich Village, or where?
Oh boy, absolutely. And you know, it was such a tiny, when you look at it now, you say, how could those few blocks in the southern part of Manhattan have changed the world? Because they did. All of this incredible music. Everybody showed up there. And when I got to singing that night, that my first night, I was the headliner. I was kind of surprised. I mean, I didn't understand that things go this. They went viral even before the internet. And so I got there and I was very happy. And they said, oh, yes, well, you're the headliner. But then a gentleman came over to me and he said, well, you know, you have an opener. And I said, well, who would that be? He said, well, that's Arlo Guthrie.
Oh, my word.
He was 13 years old and he was my opener.
Isn't that incredible?
Instant friends, of course. And from that population, because I lived in New York, Harold was my manager. Everybody was in New York and Carnegie Hall was in New York. So I had already opened by 1962. I'd already opened for Theodore Bickel. And so in a way, the door was opened here to me in a way that was phenomenal.
Gosh, and you did it organically, it sounds like. And yes, you did have a dad sort of kind of in the biz, but you know, it sounds like you really forged your own way in music. And back then, you hear about women trying to come up in the music business, and they're not all fabulous tales of, you know, just instant stardom and, you know, being paid well and everything beautiful. But for you, it sounds like you had a pretty good trajectory that you were able to wait. How old were you at this point back then when you were opening like this and headlining?
By the time I opened for Theodore Bickel at Carnegie Hall in October, let's see, so that would have been, that's 1962, and I would have been 23. So I already had behind me this incredibly vast and important growing up time. When I was a concert pianist, I played Mozart with my teacher's symphony. I was working on the Rachmaninoff piano concerto. I was singing always. I was singing in school shows. I had my own group together. We had shows. My best friends were dancers. We put on the Little Red Riding Hood with the story I wrote. And we put on the Gypsy Rover, which I sang while they danced the story. So I'd always had to work. I'd had to work hard. Uh-huh. And I had to be, you know, I always say, making a joke of it, you know, I had to practice a couple hours a day on the piano. And, you know, it ruined my social life, but I made up for it in the 60s.
Right.
So my background was full of a lot of things. And what I also got from my dad, he was a wonderful performer, marvelous pianist, wonderful singer. And my godfather was also a singer. He sang with one of the big choirs, the Shaw Chorale. What's his first name? Walter Shaw Chorale. He sang with, he had his own debut in Carnegie Hall. So I was always surrounded by great singing and wonderful piano and wonderful, you know, all of that rich collection in the American Songbook, and the discipline, which is what I learned how to do. And when people say to me, you know, what would you say to young people who want to do this? And I always say, well, first, think again. That's if you don't understand where you're going. Well, I don't know. If you're so innocent, then, you know, it doesn't matter, because your innocence is a kind of a defense about all the trouble you're going to run into. But it's not easy and it's hard work. But if you have the passion, then you have to go for it and you can't deny it.
Well, and it sounds like the discipline and obviously the talent. My guess is the incomparable, iconic Judy Collins. I still can't believe we're talking together right now and I'm hearing you. I mean, your voice is still like crystal. And, you know, when I think of your music, folk music, you know, this sort of, it's sort of this in-between kind of thing when you think, you know, pre-rock and sort of an out of like classics American Songbook, and then you get this you know, the 60s vibe of folk music. But yet when I hear your songbook and, you know, even Send in the Clowns or some of your other ones, there's, you do hear like your training with classical music. And also yet you were singing just the music that was big at the time, but also like the, what is the song with the Indian name and you're singing to the whales?
Oh my, Farewell to Tarawasi.
Yes. Oh my gosh.
Farewell to Tarawasi, adieu Mormon Hill. And then in the background are the singing whales, the first recording that was ever made of them. And I was in New York, and I've lived here since 1963. And in 1969, I got a phone call from the man who discovered the Public Theater, who opened the Public Theater. And Joe Papp was his name.
Oh, I love
and,
Joe
he
Papp.
He called me, and he said, do you want to be in a play in New York? And I said, absolutely not. Well, I then called him back and said, what is it? And he said, you know, my producer says that the person in this play, which was Peer Gynt with Stacy Keach, and the songs that John Morse wrote, and John Morse wrote songs for Blazing Saddles and things like that. But he had written some beautiful songs. And he said, my producers are telling me that the person who sings this part of the long-suffering Solveig, who is the wife of Peer Gynt, she has to have a voice like Judy Collins. So I said, well, why don't I just call Judy Collins, which he then did.
Uh-huh.
And,
wow.
I did call him back. This actually has a point. So I called him back and I said, look, let me listen to the songs. And I listened to John Morse's songs, which were beautiful. And so I was that summer of 1969 getting over Stephen Stills, first of all. And right. I had a part in Peer Gynt, and I sang and so on. And after the show would close, this was in the Delacorte Theater, it was in the summer. And so afterwards, people would come back to say hello. It's very open and public. And so this man wandered backstage, and he was tall, good looking. And he said, I need to show you something. I have something for you. And he handed me this little tape of whales singing. And I said, well, this is very interesting. He said, yes, this is the first recording of the humpbacked whales. It's the first recording of any singing whales. And he said, I brought it to you because I'd like you to see if you have any ideas about what could be done with this. And so I took it home and I started listening to it. And I thought, oh my God. Well, I said, I know what should happen to it. I have this old song, which I found somewhere. I have no idea where I found it. I was thinking Jim Rooney maybe took me to the Library of Congress and played this song to me. I don't know. But it's a Farewell to Tarawasi, adieu Mormon Hill, and the dear land of Crimmon, I bid thee farewell. And it's all about the whalers.
Farewell to Tarawasi, adieu Mormon Hill, and the dear land of Crimmon, I bid you farewell. I'm bound off for Greenland and ready to sail, in hopes to find riches, in hunting the whale. The cold coast of Greenland, my love, will not chill. And the longer my absence, more loving she'll feel.
Oh, Judy, see, I have goosebumps hearing that music right now. And so a lot of the music, like I said before, it seems like a lot of you shared some of the same music when at Turn, 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 which was what a hymn or Bible verse that you and Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young, you know, did. You would share this music and then you wrote a lot of your own music. And now on your 55th album, I am so amazed. 55th album for it's hard to wrap my mind around, but you have written every song on this new album. And it is also equally as beautiful as anything you have written before. Your voice is, if it's possible for a voice to get even more beautiful as the years go by, yours has. And I will play a little bit of that as we head out of the program. But I want to remind everyone that Judy Collins is playing at the Lerner Theater on Main Street in Elkhart, Indiana, October 25th. So coming right up, you must get tickets. This will be a show that will never be replicated. You'll never, ever have an opportunity to see someone of this massive talent and world-renowned and award-winning as Judy Collins and still singing. How is it, Judy, that truly, I mean, you know, you've said how when you started, we all now know it's 2024. You know, you've been in the business for 7 decades, quasi, and you're still, your voice is so perfect. How does that happen? Is that just discipline and practice over the years, or were you just blessed with a voice that never gets old?
No, I have had problems, and I was lucky because in 1965, I started losing my voice, and I was forced to come and do something about it. So I called Harry Belafonte, and I also called I also called another friend of mine whose parents ran a big arts school in Lenox, Massachusetts. They both gave me the same name. I went to see this man who was a genius. And his name was Max Margulies, and I studied with him for 32 years. And he taught me what to do to get through, to be able. He said, if you do this, if you continue to think about clarity and phrasing, if you, in other words, he used to say, you know, if you listen to a singer and you can understand the words, they're singing well. And if you're singing well, you can still sing until you fall over. So that's where I'm headed.
that's where you must be headed. And I can only imagine, I'm going to come see you, but I can only imagine that you weave your beautiful stories of your life throughout the music that you play because you have so many of them.
Yes, I do. And I love to tell jokes. So be plan to bring both a Kleenex and a handkerchief and a laugh track.
A laugh track. Well, it, you know, I guess since you opened up for the Smothers Brothers all those years ago, and yes, they were funny forever. I mean, they never lost their touch, but that's wonderful. And so people are in for such an incredible treat on October 25th at the Lerner Theater to see Judy Collins. Oh, my breath has been taken away. You have this beautiful new album. It's called Spellbound. We're going to go out with that song, but just tell me a little bit of the premise behind the songs. What was the motivational push towards writing all these on your own? And what is there any thematic sequence to them?
I'm coming out with a book of poetry next year. It's called Sometimes It's Heaven. And it's a collection of poetry that I've worked on for years. But one of the things that I did was to write a poem every day in 2016. And out of those songs, a lot of this material, which is on Spellbound, came. I can remember where I was standing in Hawaii at a hotel, looking out at the green and writing the words to Spellbound. Where was I?
A windy day.
In Honolulu. Windy day.
In Honolulu, yes. And oh, wait till you hear it. But it is so aspirational. It is so beautiful. And so I look forward to hearing about the poetry book. Do come back on if you can when the book is published. But in the meantime, we're going to go out on the namesake of the album, Spellbound. Judy Collins, thank you for your gift. Thank you for all you have blessed this entire earth with. this spirit, this heart, this soul, this magical music that you have made for, that's only brought joy to everyone who's heard your beautiful voice. Thank you for joining us today on the way home. I don't know what else to say.
Thank you, Laura. You're a gem, and I appreciate so much your having me on your show. Good luck. God bless everybody.
You too. Here she is on Spellbound, her new album.
Windy day in Honolulu, looking out beyond the hills, memories and times of heartache, lays of lilies, daffodils. Here I lighted like a bird upon the bright blue water shore, with my hope and with my nightmares, praying I could swim and soar. Dark dreams haunted sunlit days, while I drank down rum and hope, burning dreams and crimson lovers, dancing on a thin tightrope. Spellbound, spellbound, spellbound. Birds of paradise were walking as though they were angel songs. Bright wings flew along the beaches in their shimmering sarongs, and I thought when I would see them so content and so serene, how could I find that surrender? I could fly, but I would scream, fighting out of beauty's trance in the light of sand and water, knowing I would crawl the highways, finding my own kind of slaughter.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Way Home with Laura Smith. Here's Laura.
Well, a lot of us do really big things in our lives. We buy homes and we sell them. We mount businesses and we sell those too, or we have to leave them. All these sort of huge life chapters, but sometimes they do come to an end. And always we should really know what we're doing and kind of plan for that. Myself, not so good at it, but there's someone who is and has a great book that you're going to want to get if you or someone you know needs to think of the future when it comes to letting go of your business or selling it, so to speak. It's called What is Your Exit Strategy? Maximize Your Business Mindset, Minimize the Minefields. I love the title. Linda Jensen, thank you so much for joining us today.
Now, thank you, Laura.
You're a certified exit planning advisor. Now, I love that. Can you like go to school for that? What is that? Certified?
We actually do. It's pretty involved training, and there's an exam that you take to be certified. And it's a really wonderful community of people that are all dedicated with helping businesses sell successfully.
So that's so interesting, because I always think of, you know, what it would be to have my own business. And then once I did, how would it get going, and then how does it stay afloat, and you know, all these things. I never once thought, and then what happens to it when it's time to leave? I just don't ever think of that, you know. And it's the same thing I said, like when you're buying a house, the last thing you want to think about is, you know, the day you're packing up and selling, because you're just too excited about the next chapter in front of you. So is that something that can actually be achieved? Can you actually know what your exit strategy is going to be way before you've even had a long run with your business?
Well, I would say probably not. I mean, your typical business owner, Laura, is so busy and wrapped up running their business, and that they're really not thinking about exiting. And if they do, they think it's going to be a pretty simple process, but it isn't. And a lot is really involved. Like I say, exit planning is really a team sport. And most business owners think it's pretty simple and they'll just be able to do it by themselves. This book is full of stories. We did about 20 interviews. And I will tell you, every one of these exit planning specialists and advisors told me stories about businesses that were consistently overvaluing their business. They put a number that was higher than the business was actually worth. And when you think about it, Laura, that business owner needs to cash out that business to continue their lifestyle, don't they? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, having a good exit strategy in place, understanding what they have to do. The first half of the book lays out a lot of issues and the minefields. And the second half of the book is really about a lot of solutions, is how it's laid out.
Well, I know that you have what you call the five D's. Mm-hmm. And is that in the first part of the book or the second?
Well, that's some of the issues here. Exactly. So, you know, and I will tell you that the main reason I wrote this book is when I really understood that only about 20% of businesses actually sell, Laura. Mm-hmm. And with the baby boomers exiting over the next 10 years or so, there could be millions of businesses at risk of going away. So there's that stat. And the other stat is the fact that 50% of businesses sell involuntarily. And that's exactly because of the five D's. So every one of these folks that we interviewed told me stories about a business owner they were working with to sell their business, and they literally dropped dead in the process. So death is one, disability is another. Let's say the business is owned by a husband and wife and they're getting divorced. You know, they might be good business partners, but they're lousy marriage partners. That can create a lot of problems. There could be duress in the business, you know, like COVID, you know, the Great Recession, a lawsuit. There could be a partners that have disagreements. And, you know, so that's really, those are really, that is responsible, Laura, for 50% of businesses selling involuntarily because those business owners don't have a plan, basically.
Right. And I saw that you laid it out that if 10 businesses are being launched by 10 different people, by the end of, is it 5 years, that 50% of them don't exist any longer?
That's right. Yeah.
That's not a great statistic.
Is pretty high. In fact, in my industry, the success rate is only
10%. 10%. Mm-hmm. So, okay, there's most of the books out there are probably giving people tips on how to be one of the successful 10%. But you've really focused on this point of being an exit strategy. I mean, I do a lot of businesses, unless they turn into something really huge that you know, where they have the finances and everything else. I mean, do most people think of selling their business or do they pass it down to the family members? What is usually the way that they exit?
Well, you know, there's a variety of ways to exit. Sometimes they would like it to go on to the next generation and the kids don't want it. Sometimes the kids do want it. One of the stories in the book was about a guy whose nephew was his exit plan. And the kid dropped dead before he did.
Oh, boy.
And he actually said, I think I'll just throw my keys in the bushes when I'm done. I mean, he was just so devastated, you know. So some people will sell through an M&A company. Some will sell through a business broker. But before you get to that point, I think you want to have a plan. You want to have a team in place because guess what? That buyer is going to have a team. You want to have a realistic valuation of your business. One of my favorite chapters in the book is about methodology that was developed by the Exit Planning Institute. It's called Value Acceleration. And my strategic partner last year, Laura, their average business client's profits went up 65% and their revenue 43%. So going through that process puts the business owner always in a state of readiness. They do it in 90-day sprints, and you're going to, at the end of the 90 days, do you want to keep growing or do you want to get out, right? So that business owner is always prepared. They will be prepared for the five Ds. They will be prepared to exit their business and have control and actually sell it when they want to, and it will have value, real enterprise value.
And like selling anything, doesn't the person selling have to have a realistic view of what the value is? I know that I worked for a company one time that wanted to be sold. They wanted to make a lot of money, get really famous quick, and then and sell. And that was the strategy. And so they kind of beefed up all these, I think they were probably false, you know, false numbers, basically, yeah. metrics and things like that. And, you know, then once they were found out, that was it. They had to have a fire sale. Nobody wanted it. And yeah. so that does that happen a lot where people, they think that they're going to be able to get away with something that perhaps isn't realistic?
Well, you know, we have to be realistic. Every one of these advisors across the board told me, you're a typical business owner overvalues their business. And you see, that's really important to get a grasp on, Laura, because, you know, that person, especially if they started that business, it's like their baby. Their blood, sweat, and tears are in that business. And they need to sell that business in a way that they can continue the lifestyle that they've created through their business. And that doesn't always happen, you see. That's where value acceleration could come in. That's why pulling in a SEPA, pulling in some experts to help you. I think a lot of business owners, Laura, think that if they have a team, that they lose control. But I really believe if you have a team, you have more control. And you're at the center of that team, by the way. You're leading the charge.
Okay. So to get a team, though, working for you, doesn't it cost money?
Well, you know, it can. You know, Value Acceleration, my partners, it costs about $3,000 a month. Cost you maybe 4 hours a month. But, you know, if you can increase your profits, you know, 50 or 60%, I think that's worth it. You know, I mean, and your team would include probably an attorney, a CPA minimum. You know, different businesses and different industries require different teams, right?
Mm-hmm.
And really exit planning, it's important to have your team in place because guess what? Your buyer is going to have their team. You see, and they're going to go over your business with a fine-tooth comb, like the story you just told, Laura. I'm quite sure that your former employer's buyer had their team, you see, and when they looked under the hood, these guys were exposed to be the frauds that they were, weren't they?
Hmm. Yeah, and it's scary because, I mean, we don't always know. If you're an employee in a company, you don't always know what's going on until you find out. But then the results are, you know, things close and it didn't get what it was supposed to, or it just closes altogether with no profit at all. And, you know, so there's that sad reality. How much do exit strategies matter for not only a big, say, corporation or a large company to a small mom and pop? Do you have to get an exit strategy for something small?
Yeah, I think even for something small, because let's say you wanted to go on to your children. Well, are the children qualified? Do they have the skills? You know, do you need to help them gain those skills? Now, I will tell you, if you get a company that has, let's say, maybe around 40 employees, one of the things that's outlined in the book is doing an ESOP. So an ESOP is when you actually sell that business to the employees. And let me tell you, the owner of the company can actually get a lot more out of it, Laura. And the reason is they still get a salary, they get their bonus, they're going to get interest on the loan. My strategic partner in this space told me a story a couple of weeks ago. He had a business he took on, $10 million enterprise value, but the owner was going to get $22 million out of it, believe it or not, after all these other things happening. So, you know, two chapters in the book. One is about internal sales, like to your kids, your partners, or your employees. And the other is external sales, you know, to, let's say, through an M&A company or a business broker, or getting a family office involved, a strategic partner, or rather a strategic buyer, you know, a private equity firm, right? There's a lot of different ways to exit, and business owners are not aware of all of their options.
And is that because it's just not, there has nobody been like you, a certified exit strategist around to have it? Is that a fairly new practice?
Yeah, well, it's not that new, but I think overall, business owners kind of minimize what it's going to take to sell their business. And they're, again, Laura, they are so caught up in the day-to-day operations of their business that they're really not aware of all these options. But I will say, if anybody's listening to this and they're serious about selling their business, please evaluate it. Please look at all of your options and get some assistance, you know, and consider putting a team together. Because let me tell you, that advice can be worth its weight in gold.
Absolutely. As with anything in life, you get someone who knows exactly what they're talking about. So if somebody were to be thinking along these lines now, hearing this, would they call someone like you, and then you would have the whole strategy for who they would need to line up? Are you like the broker of all of the other players within it?
Well, I don't sell businesses. I'm not the broker, but I have a tremendous amount of resources, Laura. And so I would say for your listeners, I mean, the book is on Kindle for 99 cents. There's going to be an Audible version. It's in print. You know, please pick it up and read it and understand all these dilemmas and all these minefields that you could be facing, because I'm an educator at heart, Laura, and I designed this book to really educate that business owner. And by telling a lot of stories to illustrate it, it's a pretty easy read. You know, somebody can do it in an evening, and it lays out all these different issues that are the problems there, but a lot of solutions that could really benefit that business owner.
Absolutely. And again, my guest is Linda Jensen. She's a certified exit planning advisor. And her book is, as she said, it's part of the pitfalls and the solutions to them if selling your business. It's called What is Your Exit Strategy? Maximize Your Business Mindset, Minimize the Minefields, and all sorts of anecdotal stories as well. Is the business running with you or without you? And why is that such a crucial question, Linda?
Well, you can't sell a business if you've created a job for yourself. And one of the stories in the book is about just that. Here's a husband and wife, very successful. They're pulling in $5 million a year in revenue, went to sell it, and they couldn't because that business did not run with or without them. And they actually hired my strategic partner. 3 years later, they sold that business for $12 million and had another business that they kept that's pulling in another $6 million a year.
Wow. I want to know their strategy.
And then I have an M&A partner that's in the book, and he had somebody come to him and say, hey, look, I got an offer of $52 million to sell my business. Now, you and I would probably say, great, let's, you know, write me that check, right? But this guy was wise and prudent enough to go back to this advisor and say, hey, Mike, do you think that's a fair offer or the best offer? And Mike's like, gosh, I don't know. If you give me some time, I'll get that out to the marketplace. And guess what, Laura? That business sold for $70 million, $18 million more.
That's incredible. And that's when you involve people who know what they're doing. And I, you know, it's easy to be sometimes penny wise and pound foolish. Like, you just don't want to spend the capital, you know, to engage a so-called team, this type of thing. But in a case like that, boy, oh boy, it sounds like it pays for itself in spades. And it's just, and what you must learn, the valuable lessons along the way. But that's very hopeful. And I bet you anybody listening right now who owns a business or is thinking of mounting a business is going to need to read your book, What is Your Exit Strategy? Maximize Your Business Mindset, Minimize the Minefields. Wonderful to have you on today. Thank you again. You can get it wherever fine books are sold, correct? Amazon has got it right there?
Absolutely. Amazon, Barnes & Noble, it's everywhere.
And again, Linda Jensen is a certified exit planning advisor. What is Your Exit Strategy is the book. Thank you so much. You've done a lot for us today. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Laura.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Way Home with Laura Smith. Here's Laura.
What a wonderful show. One for the books, one. Oh, thanks for the memories. Judy Collins, yes, and Linda Jensen, too. Well, we have one who is always one for the books. His name is Jim Cleefield, the guru of good news. And I am sure you have something lovely to end our program on today.
I do, and it was great having Judy on the show. Wonderful musician, just a legend. Well, this young man has a long ways to go to catch up to the success of a Judy Collins, that's for sure, LJ. But his story, nonetheless, as a musician, is absolutely inspiring. He was a homeless man. Now, we don't know where this story came from. His name is Andrew Donut Larson, And he's somewhere in America, was performing with his guitar, and he's a singer. He's very talented. He was homeless. He was performing not for money, but for beer. But something really special happened as a result of the kindness and generosity of a complete stranger named Alexander. And here's what happened. He was singing a song, Ghost of You. I think that's the name of the song. And it went viral on TikTok. Well, this man, Alexander, apparently must have seen this performance somewhere and decided to do something for this young man. He needed a platform so he can really have a place to record his songs, because he's just so wonderful. Wonderful. So you know what he did? Alexander started a GoFundMe page. We don't know how much money is raised, an untold amount, a lot of money. Well, this young man has totally had his life changed in more ways than one, so much so that Andrew just got his own recording contract with somebody. I don't know if it's a record label. And I just went on YouTube to see this song, Ghost of You.
What's one night right now gonna matter to me when it's next week? 25 years still seems like 20 years away. Don't you tell me that it's fate. You might as well.
This one little really wonderful thing that Alexander did by starting this GoFundMe page really was a game changer for him, and his life has changed. And you can say, LJ, to summarize this story, for Andrew Dunnett Larson, this definitely is music to his ears.
Oh, I love that. What a perfect show for that story, too. I wonder if you kind of made that happen, but as you always do. I loved it. Absolutely wonderful. And, you know, it's interesting how people get their starts. Some of them are like Judy's story, who, since she was a child, she was doing it, and then, you know, is still doing it in her, you know, 80th year. So it's really it's inspiring. But this other gentleman, sometimes they start like that. It's just a miracle.
It is an inspiring story for him, too. Yes.
Right. Exactly. Beautiful stuff. I thank you so much. You guys, you and Bob, my producer, always music to my ears, because you make it happen. Without you, forget about it. No one would get to hear the show. So thank you both. And thank you all for listening. I hope you have a wonderful week. And still, our hearts are still going out to those in the southeastern part of the United States, still struggling from all the storms, the hurricanes and stuff. Please know we love you. God bless you. And in any way we can help, we will. This is The Way Home. We'll see you next time. I'm Laura Smith.